Yeah.
And my mother died when I was just a baby. And so, like just a few months old, when my dad's sister took over, and they brought me out here to Seattle, where another of my dad's sisters, you know, my dad's sisters, and they brought me out here to Seattle, and my one aunt was living here, so the other aunt was had just come out here from Chicago. But anyway, I was living is so she they brought me out here, and I was here until I was about 7 years old. Then my dad, meantime, after my mother passed away, well, he quit Wisconsin and came west to Montana, and he found out a homestead in that township near Fairfield.
Yeah.
And so, and he talked to his sister and brother-in-law to come over there and homestead also. So my uncle, his name was Robert Stubbins, they decided they would do that. So they rented their house here in Seattle. And so my uncle he bought a team of horses and a wagon, and they had a cow, and they had some chickens, a dog and a cat, and all the furniture and everything. They moved it and put it into a boxcar. And they loaded the boxcar in Power, Montana. Then the train went from Power to Great Falls and on to Spokane. And the uncle went with the boxcar, see, with the furniture and the dogs and the cats and the horses. Or a team of horses, a wagon, and everything. He went into the he rode in the boxcar with all that stuff all the way to from Seattle to Power, Montana.
Yeah.
Then my dad met him with his team of horses, and then they loaded everything on the wagons and on my dad's wagon. Then the whole outfit went out across the prairies. There wasn't very many section lines in those
Right.
days,
Yeah.
so we went across the prairies and we wound up at my dad's homestead. So then they built a little tent house, and it was in the fall of the year, and so we slept in that tent house all one winter while my dad was while they were building their house on their homestead. See,
What was that house, tent house, like? Was you
well,
mean,
it
did it
was
have a
a it
frame?
was a it was a frame and a floor and a kind of a door, and then the tent was fastened to this outside of this frame. See, and had a ridge pole, and come down, and then it had a. Had a had a then the tent was draped over that, and then they had all the eye the tent the eyes, you know, and they fastened all around the sides with that.
Was it a framework you could have built a house on
No,
eventually?
no,
No,
you couldn't.
it
No, it
wasn't.
was just
It
made for
was
that
for a
purpose,
tent.
one
Okay.
purpose.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I never forget how in the wintertime, the wind started to blow that old tangle boom.
Yeah.
How cold it was in there, you
Only
know.
balloon in and
Oh,
out. Huh?
it was cold in there because my dad only had a one room homestead shack, and so we couldn't all live and stay in there. So we,
Well, how many of you in the tent house then?
well, it was
The
my
whole.
aunt, my uncle, and myself, and my dad stayed in the house, in his shack.
Yeah.
And then his shack had it had a trap door, and then you went down underneath, and that was where he kept his potatoes and stuff like
Yeah.
that.
Okay. But what year was that
That
you
was
went out
about
there?
1916.
16
Just
and.
about just what time the, just after the war started. So we moved over there just after World War I started.
Yeah,
See,
it started in 14,
14, yeah.
and the U.S.
And
went
it
in
ended in eight in 19, 18.
18,
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah, okay. How old were you when you went there then?
I was about seven, and I
About
and
seven.
about 7 years old.
Yeah.
And I started a school over there in this one room country school. I got a picture. Or matter of fact, I got a picture of it there too.
Well, did you stay out there in that country till 26, until 1926?
Well,
Then,
I was out there from then till 1922. Then my aunt came over one fall, and they decided maybe that'd be a good idea if I went with her out here to Seattle, went to school out here. So, but anyway, I came with her in the fall of 22, and then I stayed here until the spring of 24. Then my dad was out old enough. He thought of me. He got to help me with the farm work. See, so I went back to Montana. I didn't care too much about it. I was living there, and I liked it both in Seattle. But I got back over there again. I stayed there another 24, 25, and 26. Yeah, I stayed there about another 2.5 years or so.
How big was that tent house before
well,
I lose track of that?
It was
roughly.
Big enough to. Put a bed and just the drawers and stuff in, you know. It was probably 12 by 10 by 12, something approximately like that. I'm just guessing on it. Mm-hmm. And then with a kid, you know, it looked pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. Just one room, they didn't use any dividers, or did they?
No, just
didn't hang a blanket or anything. No.
Just crawl under blankets and had lots of them all on top of you.
Yeah, yeah. What did you use for a stove?
Oh, they didn't have any heat in the tent. They they had the heat in the
your dad's place?
Homestead shack.
Oh,
they had a stove in there, and that's my aunt cooked in there. See, and uh-huh. did all their cooking and eating in the old homestead shack. See, one room homestead shack. It had a little window on the west side, window on the west side, one on the south side, but none on the north side.
God, that must have been pretty wintry in that thing.
It was. You know. Then they built their house. In the meantime, they were building their house about a half a mile away down on their property, see?
Yeah.
And that house is a... I've got a picture of it
right here. Okay.
That whole album looks kind of... Here's the school I went to over there. And here's our confirmation class.
Uh-huh.
And here's when the irrigation drops. And there's one of our cows, and my dad and myself, and... Here's me with my bicycle,
okay. Hey, where this is from Fairfield?
Oh, it's about 11 miles, 11 miles more or less north by east from Fairfield, about 11 miles from Fairfield, where we live.
North by east, okay,
east,
yeah.
East and north a little bit.
Yeah, was Fairfield the nearest, community?
Well, there was another one, it's called Cleve. Now it's only an elevator, a little post office, and a grocery store, and a little boxcar waiting station. No, Dave, when they used. Well, yeah, here's the house we lived in.
Uh-huh. Right, okay, let me get a look at that. What were they all doing out there?
Farming, I guess. Yes, they were farming. Of course, my uncle had a trade. My dad, I call him my uncle. It was my dad's brother-in-law. He was a painter and decorator, so he got a lot of jobs over there, paper hanging paper hanging and painting and so on and so forth. And I never forget about the weather, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This house had the ship drop siding on the outside. Then on it had the shiplap on the inside to finish the inside. And over that they had what they call oatmeal paper.
Oh, yeah.
And then you could put wallpaper on it if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But I never forget in a real cold weather, the frost comes through, those frost spots come through the wallpaper.
Show up on the
outside of the wallpaper inside the house.
Huh.
Now, this is during the flu epidemic, and there was this fellow, there was two guys died of the flu. Yeah. His name was Ole Ingebrigtsen and Ole Vervik. They both of them died at the same time. They had a double funeral, and they went and got the coffins and hauled them out from Great Falls and on this little old Model T truck, and that was the hearse, and they did their own planting, see, you know what I mean, servicing. I mean, they didn't take the bodies to Great Falls. They just went and got the caskets, put them in them, and buried them. That's it. That was the way they did it.
Yeah, so this, taking the tape recorder, this is a picture of two caskets
side by side
on a little
Model T Ford flatbed
truck, yeah. Huh.
And that's St. Paul's Lutheran Church. Now, that's... Uh-huh. That has been redone since I was there. It's all fixed up real nice now. It's got a basement in it and everything.
Now, is that out by the homestead?
Oh, that's about, that's not far from the homestead. It's about, I guess about 4 miles from the homestead or so.
I've never been out in that.
I went to that. As a matter of fact, my confirmation picture is here at this church. See.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a pretty good looking house your uncle built.
This guy that's
two-story.
Mm-hmm. It's a kind of upstairs, and it's just they slept up there, and this was a living room here, and then a kitchen, and then they had a little stairway that went up into the loft. See?
Yeah, yeah. What were they trying to grow out there?
All their wheat,
raising wheat,
and they had only had 80 acres, and in those days, a person could almost just barely make a living off of it.
Yeah.
And what they did, you know, originally they went and filed a homestead, then they went to work and they built a shack on it. As long as you lived on it, then that homestead was yours. Then they went to work and they bought machinery. Then they started to take mortgages on the homestead to get machinery and stuff like that. So when they broke the prairie sod, matter of fact, here's the, oh, anyway, I got a, in that boots and shovel, there's a picture of the old steam engine that used to do it. They used to, they broke the prairie sod, see?
Mm-hmm.
And when they broke that, well, then they planted the wheat and the crops they had. Boy, they had bumper crops.
Yeah.
Well, like, they never thought anything about using fertilizer, you know, in those days. And then after that, then the soil it started to use all the nutrients out of the soil, so eventually the crops weren't so mm-hmm. good from then on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until some of those farmers got... They plowed their stubble under and then used this stubble as mulch.
Yeah.
And then a lot of them left the stubble, and then when the wind blew, it would catch the... And then it did mulch it in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see. The weather turned bad summers there, too.
We had quite a few droughts, and wheat was the crop was very poor.
Uh-huh.
Then after that, come all kinds of pests. One year it would be grasshoppers. Some years it would be hailed out.
Mm-hmm.
Some years it would be Russian thistles that take over.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would be wild oats. And when it got the irrigation, and wild oats took over. Oh, that just you get in among the wheat and you have nothing but wild oats instead of wheat.
Why do you suppose the irrigation...
I don't know. It triggered something.
Yeah.
Then when we got the irrigation, then all the local, like on our place, this place here,
mm-hmm.
To the right of the house here, just to the right side, there was a little draw, just a slight draw. And where that draw started, and it kept going down into a deep coulee. About 7-8 miles further down, it was a deep coulee.
Mm-hmm.
And that ran into what they called a big muddy. And that coulee ran into a big... And when it got way down there, there was the creek started, the springs, mm-hmm. you know. And then before it ran into the muddy, there was a little creek running into the muddy from springs
that
accumulated. Well, then, when they got irrigation... Then all those low places, it started to, the water started running down there, and it ran all year round. That finally started running all year round. The water did.
Huh.
Then cattails started to grow. Then willows started to grow. Then different kinds of birds started coming in. Red-winged blackbirds, mm-hmm. we never seen before. They came in.
Huh.
And then in the wintertime, the little creek there would freeze over. And you'd have it. You'd water come up, and it'd spread out. And then before it started to thaw, that creek, instead of being a matter of a few feet wide, would be several, maybe 25 or 30 feet wide.
Is that right?
It's done with ice.
Huh?
They used to go skating on it. You know, rough skating, but sometimes you find a nice.
So this irrigation would kind of create a little swamp.
It created a problem.
Sense,
it created swamps, and our cows would get down there and get stuck, and all we had a heck of a time.
Mm-hmm.
Then finally they brought in a great big, while I was over here, before I went back to Montana, the big drag line had come through our place and dug a drain ditch. And that drain ditch went for miles, you know,
mm-hmm.
and picking up, followed the coulee where the water was accumulating. They went and dug these drain ditches, and then they drained the water off. And that drain ditch had run, after that, run all the year round.
Hmm.
They're taking the surface water off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cross caused by the irrigation. Before that, they never had any moisture problem like that.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You were out there when the irrigation arrived?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, here's a sort of picture of the irrigation coming down the ditch here someplace. I forget where it was. They even had a protest of the irrigation originally, according to this picture.
Your memory of seeing the stuff come down the ditch. You're telling me.
I thought, you know, you imagine when they turn the water on, it'd be a big wall of water coming down the ditch. Here was a little tiny trickle, just creeping along, with all kinds of sticks and Russian thistles and everything.
Yeah.
And it just kept trickling along, just barely moving about. Well, you could walk faster than the water was coming.
Huh.
Then it kept getting deeper, a little deeper, as it tapered down. And it got deeper and deeper until the ditch was about a fourth full, see?
Mm-hmm.
And then that come, then it would, all these, it come down these drops, you know, big, just a trickle of muddy water with all the tweeds and their thistles and everything coming down the muddy drops, and roaring down in and drop into the, come into the drop for the first time, you know? Huh.
Is this a main ditch?
Yeah, the main ditch, uh-huh. They come from all the way from the Pishkan Reservoir,
uh-huh.
which was up...
I know where that is.
Yeah, it's a Pishkan Reservoir.
Uh-huh.
And that's where it came from, to get to our place. And, of course, going down there, I didn't know all this stuff until later, that they had siphons and everything else to get the water down there. You know, they had quite an engineering for progress, because I was all, you know, being a kid, all that stuff. But I never did get to see the Sun River Dam, where the water come from. It come out of the Sun River Dam. That was the story down from the Sun River. They call it Sun River Dam.
Would that be, that's probably not the Gibson Dam.
Probably was part, and then the Gibson Dam come later, I think. Yeah. Or maybe they changed the name of it.
Might be, or they might build it higher. I'm not
they
sure.
Could have built it, they could have changed the name to the old, we call it the Sun River Dam, and then it might have become the Gibson Dam. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I remember the Pishkun Reservoir.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And now I forget, one time, I was just before I came over here, I was working for a fellow named E.P. Garnes, who also homesteaded over there, a neighbor of ours. And when we lost the farm, and our farm, and then my uncle, we worked his place. But anyway, the last year I was over there, my dad leased government land, and I he got sick, and I had to put in the whole darn crop and do everything myself. You know, I was 16 years old.
Hmm.
But anyway, I was working for this when my dad could no longer farm, and I was kind of on my way. I worked for other farmers around there. The last fall I was over there, I worked with the thrashing crew for a while. Then I finally worked for this E.P. Garnes for a while, and we had to go up. They used to pasture cattle on the what they call the Willow Creek Game Preserve, and I forget how many thousands of acres it was, but it was all fenced in, and they'd drive their cattle up there, and they used to pasture them for 50 cents a head for a month or whatever it was for the summer. Our neighbor, Garnes' neighbor, and Garnes himself, between the two of them, they had about 85 head of cattle that they grazed up there. So Garnes' brother-in-law and myself had the job of riding up there on horseback, clear up to this, miles and miles to go, up to Pishkun Reservoir, up to this Willow Creek Game Preserve. And then we had to round the cattle up and get all their cattle and separate it from the rest of them and get them in a corral. Then the next day we drove them from the Willow Creek Game Preserve down to their homestead, their ranch, or their house, their farm steads.
Yeah.
And then separate the cattle again there and the Svenby's cattle and Garnes' cattle had to be all separated, and then they got them back.
Where was this Willow Creek
government game preserve.
Yeah, where was it located?
Was it up there? Near the Pishkun Reservoir
was
area.
Up,
yeah,
up
in
there,
that area.
So it'd be west or
northwest. West of Fairfield, anyway.
West of, Fairfield, yeah.
And they went up in an old Chevrolet truck. And then we rode horseback and they went in this old Chevrolet. Well, they caught up with us around noon. We were about, I guess we were quite a ways from it was getting way late in the afternoon. They finally caught up with us. We had a sandwich or two, and then we took off again. Before we got to the ranger's place, and it got dark, and we missed the entrance.
Oh, yeah?
So we stayed out all that night. It was getting frosty. It was the fall of the year. It was cold. No place to stay. We pulled into a ranch place there, and it was an old Model T Ford pulled out there and took off. And we went in there and looked around, and the old house had been, they thrashed wheat, and they put the grain inside this old house, and there was a straw stack there in the barn. So we tried to crawl up in the barn and try to use our saddle blankets to try to get to sleep, and the darn mice were so thick in there, you couldn't sleep. So we crawled into the straw stack and crawled in under the straw, and managed that. And Martin Brunwell, he was Ed Gerson Brunwell, he drank some water out of a little creek there, and it was strong alkali.
Oh.
And he just like Epsom salts,
and
he had a heck of a time. Well, I didn't drink any of it.
Huh.
And then the next day, we started out again and tried to find this place. And finally, the ranger caught up with us, and he said, I've been looking for you. You guys, I said, we must have missed the entrance to the place. So then he got us in there. Boy, I was never so hungry in all my life. Hadn't anything to eat for about 24 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was hungry. Then we got there, and we stayed all night. And then the next day, we started driving the cattle back down.
Yeah.
And
then
on the way back down there, it started to snow. And there's a lake trace of snow. And some of the places we had to take down barbed wire fences to get the cattle through, and nail them back up again. And then we come to an old reclamation camp, and we couldn't make it in one day, so we had to stay in this reclamation camp overnight. And they got a fire. They got into this one of these old bunk houses, you know, and got a fire started, and it was pretty. It was pretty. Wasn't too bad to sleep in there.
Yeah.
But old Garnish, I slept with him. And he's just out riding horseback all night long, moving and kicking and gouging.
Yeah.
So the next morning, we got out in the trace of snow on the road. We couldn't find the cattle, and we finally found them down in another coulee. So we ran them up again and got them, and we made it home that night.
That's
that was about my last. Of being in Montana, then just right about 2 weeks later, I was on my way out here.
Uh-huh. Enough cowboying, huh?
Enough cowboying, yeah.
Tell me about the homestead community. Were there a lot of homesteaders came in at the same time you guys did?
Well, it was, from about 1907, early 1900s. Well, I guess what I understand when I read this book, I didn't know it at the time, but I do remember the old horse barn. There used to be a right now we're near the school where we went to school.
What was the school called, incidentally?
It was East Fairfield School.
East Fairfield, yeah.
There was a West Fairfield School and the East Fairfield School, and I went to the East Fairfield School. And it was a one-room school with a teacherage on the side, a little one-room shack where the teacher stayed, and they had furniture with wood and coal and stuff like that, and they furnished her with food, I guess. And she got about $40 a month, I think it was. And anyway, right about a half a mile or so from the school, in this where this draw come down from our place, went kept getting a little bit deeper all the way along, you know, and finally got down where the horse barn was quite a deep draw. See, then east of that it started going deeper and deeper. It got into the big muddy. But anyway, right there along that draw was this old horse barn, and it was called the old Adams Ranch. It's part of the old Adams Ranch. So I understood it, they divided up this old Adams Ranch. And turned it into homesteading.
Oh.
And this Adam Ranch, I guess, was a huge, big, great big operation.
Huh.
And in the barn, they say that was even Charles M. Russell carved his initials in there because he'd been there.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a way station between Great Falls and Shoto.
Huh.
The stagecoaches went from Great Falls to Shoto. They stopped off at this horse barn and got to take overnight, you know.
Well, were there any particular nationality of homesteaders?
Well, there was mixtures of Norwegian, German, and Swedes. Mostly Norwegian. You know, there's this Vervik talking about this. Vervik, I still correspond with the oldest brother. And he, of course, the youngest brother passed away. And there's two brothers left, plus one sister. But anyway, his mother and father... came right from Norway. They were sponsored by someone in back east somewhere. They had some relatives that got them over here. So Ole Vervik, he was the one that passed away with the flu. He had 34 years old and left a pregnant wife and with four other children.
Jeez. Yeah.
So then the widow had to. She leased the farm out then on sharecropping, you know, till the oldest boy got old enough to start farming.
Yeah.
But anyway, they came right from Norway, right from Stavanger, Norway, and they wound up in Great Falls, Montana. He was a baker, so he worked in a bakery over there, and they heard about this homesteading out here on this Fairfield in the Greenfield area. So they decided to go out there and homestead. So they took up a homestead. And I remember my aunt and uncle, before they filed on the homestead over there, we took a trip one time, and I was just a small kid. We got on the Milwaukee Railroad, went all the way back to Ohio and all over. And we wound up in Montana there for a short, before we stayed overnight in my dad's shack up there, homestead shack. But that was before we moved over there,
That
was way back in 1913, I think it was.
Huh.
And I still remember going into the Vervik's place. The mother and the father and Agnes and Bert and Art. They were three kids then, and they had a one room homestead shack, and they all lived in that one room until they built a nice home.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, they still have the home. It's a nice home. And I can still remember that the kids, I couldn't understand them, see, because they spoke Norwegian.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand them.
So
And I remember when we moved over there then, and I started school, and they all started school about the same time, see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they couldn't speak English, so, but they learned pretty fast, because mm-hmm. they got to school, they had to learn to speak English. So.
Yeah. Do you guys call them Norskies? That's what we used to call them.
Norwegians. Norwegians. I'm Norwegian myself. Yeah. My folks came from Norway.
Uh-huh.
So my dad could speak with them, but when I was raised with my aunt and uncle here, she married a Scotch Irishman, and there were no Norwegians spoken around me.
Did your dad lose his place, you say?
Yeah, he lost it through. He mortgaged it too heavy, and so many failures, you know.
Was that pretty much the case there in that case, area?
That was. A lot of them happened. A lot of them was able to hang on to the places, and and so he lost the place and through mortgage. He had a mortgage with this Pete Nesset, and he was the one that kind of loaned money to all the different farms. He had quite a bit of money. He had got a lot of land holdings, and anyway, he got so he couldn't. He didn't have enough income to failure after failure after failure. Yeah. You know, one thing after another.
Yeah.
So he got too much for him. He couldn't hang.
You guys did your shopping in Fairfield.
Oh yeah.
Going to town for supplies.
Or I'd either go to Fairfield or I'd go to Cleve.
Mm.
I'll never forget.
Cleve did have a store.
Yeah, it had a little store and a post office and a grain elevator, and it was on a branch of the Great Northern. See, Fairfield was on a branch of the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad. And it came out of Great. They both came out of Great Falls. Mm-hmm. See, the line from Great Falls went from Great Falls to Shelby, and it hit the northern main line there.
Right.
Well, then they had a branch line that came off of at Power, Montana, and it came up through this valley and up to Cleve. What was the name of that little place? Anyways. There's another little boxcar station, and then finally come to Cleve, and then on up, and they turned around at Bynum. Bynum.
Oh, Penroy, I think.
Penroy, that's the name. Yeah. I think the Milwaukee turned around at Penroy, and the Great Northern turned around at Bynum. And then he turned around and came back. See?
Yeah.
Well, anyway. That Cleve was on that Great Northern line, see?
Uh-huh.
And Fairfield was on the Milwaukee line.
Yeah.
And so my dad was out of, it was in March, and it was cold as the dickens, and the snow was just, there was hardly any breath of air, and the snow was coming down, it was light, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had about 4 inches of snow on the ground, so I had to get on one of the horses and take off for Cleve to get him some chewing tobacco. He was out of chewing tobacco, and he didn't have chewing tobacco. He got kind of cranky, so.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I took off and got some went down to get the groceries and this chewing tobacco, and of course the snow had been drifting. You know, you had to go down in kind of a valley to get down there, and the southwest winds, Chinook winds, and melted some of the snow. Some drifted, you know. And around the edge of the drift was ice, you know how they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that was all covered with fresh snow, so I didn't dare. I had to lead the horse down through there because I didn't want to have him get on the ice and break. But anyway, we got through there, and I started galloping across the bottom of this valley over to where the grain elevator and the store and that was. And he stepped in the badger hole, and over we went.
Oh.
I landed in the snow. I got three of him. But anyway, nothing happened. I got back on again, and then we went in and. I got my stuff. About time I got ready to leave, the wind started to blow. And so help me, you couldn't see from here. You couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
And it was just lucky that I could follow section lines.
Oh.
And I knew what section line we lived on.
Fence lines.
I got down that fence line and right home.
Yeah.
But it was a good thing the wind was to the side of me and behind me, or that horse wouldn't have faced it. It just blew something terrible. It just white out, you know.
Yeah.
My dad, he was worried as dickens, but I finally went and made it home.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
My legs froze, my feet froze, and so did
you. Yeah, that could be pretty treacherous.
Yeah.
All right.
If it had been open prairie, I wouldn't have been here.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Huh. Well, did Fairfield seem like a big town to you guys then, or?
Well, yeah, Fairfield did. Like a big town. Oh, Great Falls. To go to Great Falls, that was a highlight.
Yeah.
Electric lights and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you do that very often? Or?
Oh, yeah. They used to take my aunt would have to, when my aunt was living over there, they used to have, once in a while, go to Great Falls. My dad would take him in a horse and buggy down to Cleve, you know, and get in this old boxcar waiting station, and we're in the grocery store where it was warm, and then when the train, you could see the train coming, you'd rush over there and get in the boxcar waiting station, and when the train pulled up, you'd get on, and on the train would be a few freight cars, and then this at the tail end of this little passenger car with smoking section for, and it smoked, and there was a place for ladies, you know, and kids weren't smoking, and then there was a little baggage, on one end of the place had a little baggage compartment where they could haul milk cans and stuff like that. But there's always a box car too, hauling grain or some whatever other things, or empty that they had to, they had hauled a bunch of box car load of stuff up to Shoto, Farmers Union, loaded and empty, was going back to Great Falls. And there's always an old steam engine with a, about what they call American type, they call 440, see? Of course, I know about that nowadays, I didn't know that in those days, see? And it was a little hand fired, the guy. As a matter of fact, I worked with a fellow. He was a owner. I worked at Pier 91 with the, for the Navy. This Henry, isn't it funny? I can't remember his name anymore. Anyway, he was a painter, and he was about time.
And it's very, very enjoyable with that because it's so putrid. It's funny.
You know something? There seems to be a pattern in the way that you give out awards. I mean, last year it was the Killer Tomatoes. This year it's Killer Pigeons?
Well, I don't know. Next year it might be Killer Bedroom Slippers.
Harry Medved, who usually holds the annual Worst Film Festival, has decided to give up watching movies and become a filmmaker.
The west of America draws some of us not because it's the newest region of the country, but because it's the oldest, in the sense that the landscape here, the fundament, nature's shape of things, more resembles the original continent than does the city nation of the eastern seaboard or the agricultural factory of the Midwest.
There was once a man, James Gilchrist Swan, who in 1841 got married in Boston and wasn't happy, left his wife and two children, spent a lot of time drinking in his room in a waterfront boarding house, and one day got on a ship that went around Cape Horn up to San Francisco and then to the Pacific Northwest, British Columbia. And there, he became an oyster trader, school teacher, railroad speculator, amateur ethnologist, doctor, lawyer, judge, homesteader, linguist, ship's outfitter, explorer, customs collector, author, small-town bureaucrat, artist, clerk. But most of all, he kept diaries, constant diaries. Every day he wrote down everything that happened.
February 6, 1865. My occupation is pretty regular every day. As soon as I get up, which is from 6:30 to 7, the Indians begin to come for medical treatment, then round to visit patients. By this time, it is 11 o'clock, and I then sit down to write, or if any children come in, try to teach them. And with the exception of a walk to Jones or Jordan's, keep in the house all the time so as to be ready either as teacher or physician. November 11th. John had a talk last evening in Russian Jim's lodge about the school. And among others who spoke, Jim said that he did not want his boy to learn to read and write, for it would be no use to him. He could not get anything by it. But if he learned to kill whales and catch halibut, he would have plenty of things. This attempt to form a school is the most unsatisfactory thing I've ever tried.
The words of James Gilchrist Swan, recorded in diaries, most of them stored over the years at the University of Washington Library, 2,500,000 handwritten words. They've all been read now by a 20th century writer, Ivan Doig, who also spent a winter's season going to the places where James Swan lived and worked.
I felt a great kinship with him, that we were both Westcomers, had invested our lives into this coast, We were interested in the first people, as the Indians called themselves. Swan is one of my first people. I look on him as one of our original tribal bards out here. So he fulfills for me somewhat what the Indians fulfilled for him.
Last evening, I shot a horned owl of the mottled gray species. This forenoon, I skinned it and prepared it for the Smithsonian Institution. The Indians think owls are dead Indians, and I had quite a talk with some children who assured me that the owl was not a bird, but an Indian. The 11th of June. Yesterday, my cat killed all my chickens. So this morning, I shot the cat.
The experiences of Swan have been traced in a new book by Ivan Doig, who lives in Seattle and often writes about the history of the American West. The title of this book is Winter Brothers. And Doig has written, "So Swan on one side of the century line, myself on the other, bearded, watchful men both, edgewalkers of the continent, more interested in one another's company than the rest of the world is interested in ours. But how deeply alike and different. That is one of the matters Swan is to tell me these journal days when I stretch across to his footings of time." Do you think that James Gilchrist Swan was an ordinary man who happened to have written all of these diaries, or that he was an extraordinary man?
I would count him extraordinary. I believe he was something like an inspired clerk in the way that, say, Samuel Pepys of the great London Diaries was. Swan was trained as a clerk in Boston, and when he came west, he brought with him that clerkly habit of putting down in his diaries day by day what he saw around him, what people told him, the Indians, the other white westcomers.
Did you ever sense the presence of Swan?
I sense rather the presence of the coast, which has endured much as it was of Swan's time. I would be in the same place Swan had been. I would be able to see some of the same things he did, hear the same waves crash. He spoke once of the organ-like sound of the waves breaking on Nia Bay, and I was able to hear things of such as that.
Last night was very calm, and at 11 p.m. there was but little surf on the beach, and the air being perfectly still, the least sound could be noticed. As the swell of the ocean gently fell on the sands and receded, it sounded like harmonious music. I laid awake an hour listening to it. The air seemed at times filled with the steady notes of some great organ.
And Ivan Doig has written about the last day of James Swan. Sometime in the morning of the 18th of May, Swan lies in his room and listens for footsteps. They are slow to come, time needed for it to dawn on one or another downtown citizen of Port Townsend that the old man has not been seen to emerge to the street as usual. Feet at last are heard, and a knock through the door. The silence, all too much answer. The inquiring friend forces in to find Swan where the stroke has pinned him. Life stays in Swan through that paralyzing day, but only half the night. James Gilchrist Swan, pioneer historian, born Medford, Massachusetts, 1818, died Port Townsend, Washington, 1900, a winter brother of Ivan Doig.
Ivan Doig talked with us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. His book, Winter Brothers, is published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. The diary excerpts, the words of James Swan, were read by New York actor Russell Horton.
And for this evening, that's All Things Considered.
WEPR Clemson, South Carolina, also helped out tonight.
Our program was produced by Alex Chadwick, edited by Celeste Wesson, directed by Art Silverman, the audio technicians, Norb Gallery, and Karen Bleckman. Funds for...
Counties. It's a football marathon. That's the description for the weekend happenings at the Seattle King Dome as the top high school teams in the state met in the 8th annual King Dome. A 5-game showcase. Bob Post has his report.